Welcome to Cuckoo Bananas. I'm Mike Buongiorno. I'm joined as always by my trusty companion, Kate Ganey.
Howdy.
How you doing, cowpoke?
Okay. Howdy. We watch a lot of Sheriff Callie in the house.
I don't know what that is.
It's a Disney Junior show. It's super cute. Mandy Moore voices a little calico cat out in the Wild West.
I'm interested.
See?
I love Mandy Moore.
This show is not sponsored by Sheriff Kelly or Mandy Moore.
Do your kids watch Bluey?
Oh my gosh, we love Bluey.
Everybody Bluey I know best. Loves Bluey.
It's very funny. It's really, really funny. And I love that my kids, because of watching so much like British and Australian TV, They say things like, my daughter recently went away with her grandmother and she said she was on holiday.
I love it.
She was like, well, when I go on holiday... All right, this is precious.
Do your children casually call people cunt?
Oh, God, I wish.
That's a very Australian thing.
I really wish my son was like, oi, cunt.
What's, there's an Australian saying, you call your mates cunt and you call cunts mate. Because if somebody's coming up to you to try to fight you, you say like, what's going on, mate?
Yeah.
You and mate? It's and like, then to your best friends, hey, you cunt.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I'm fascinated and terrified of everything Australian.
And terrified. I mean, I from what I see on the internet, which, you know, I don't know anything. It seems like they've got some serious big bugs and all sorts of things that could eat you.
Yeah, I think pretty much everything on that continent is trying to kill you.
Yeah, but it is beautiful. I no, guess
there's that. It's beautiful. I don't know.
Well, while we're talking about continents, segue. Today's episode, me and Kate are going to discuss the new book by John Green, The Anthropocene Reviewed. What's the subtitle? There's a subtitle to it.
You know, I could tell you.
I got Kindle on my phone.
Essays on a Human-Centered Planet.
Love it. So the Anthropocene is the suggested name for the epoch we're living in. Epoch spelled like epoch. And I always read it epoch because I'm dumb. And basically, this is a book of reviews, but it's so much more than that, isn't it?
It sure is. I can't read anymore. And this has to do with mental health. My therapist actually kind of put it in perspective for me because I used to beat myself up about not being able to sit down with a book like I used to. And, you know, she broke it to me easy. She was like, hey, you know, PTSD is brain damage. Maybe that's just a thing your brain can't do anymore. And I was talking to a friend about that. And I was like, you know, if you break a bone or something, it heals. But it feels a little funky sometimes when it's raining and, you know, whatever. So I kind of liken it to that. Like there's this part of my brain that just, you know.
Yeah.
When my brain has been healing, it didn't heal back exactly as it once was.
But let me say, I used to have a prejudice against audiobooks, but I was being wrong. I was being snotty.
Ableist.
I was being ableist. And I was not just ableist, but also just snotty.
Yeah.
Like, you know, many people like audiobooks. I just happen to not like them.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that you learn in like media studies is that like you kind of read everything. You read video games, you read images, you read music. So whether or not you're reading a textbook or listening to an audiobook, I still feel that the verb read is correct.
Yeah.
And there should be no shame about it.
Yeah, I agree. I think I kind of used to feel the same, that it's not quote unquote reading or whatever, but you know what? You're still digesting that information. It honestly sometimes affects me in a different way than I think sitting down with a physical text and looking at it would. And when you find an audiobook that's narrated by, you know, either an author that has a really great voice and, you know, performs well, or a really great performer, it's fantastic. Like I listened to a book recently narrated by J.K. Simmons. And it was great. It was fantastic. Like, I listened to another book recently. I found myself, I tricked myself because I really enjoy Scottish accents.
Sure.
So I decided to listen to a self-help book that was narrated by a Scot.
Love
and it. And that it was a pleasure to listen to.
I listened to this podcast called Poetry Unbound, and it's a poetry podcast, but the host is Irish.
Oh, lovely.
So every poem just sounds 10 times better because he's Irish.
Beautiful. It's so beautiful. I hate American accents. Yeah.
And John Green, the author of this book, he's as prolific as a YouTuber, YouTube entity, as he is an author.
Mm-hmm.
So he has a great voice, and when I read it in his voice, because I know his voice so well from all the various videos he's made. From, you know, he does Vlog Brothers with his brother Hank. He created Crash Course. Tons and tons of cool stuff on the internet comes from him. So I think that's awesome. I kind of want to listen to how he would do it. See, my illness is I can't concentrate. Like, same thing with podcasts that are storytelling podcasts. I zone out and then I'm like, shit, what did I just miss? So yeah. I can't do audiobooks for that reason.
See, that happens to me sometimes. And sometimes I will go back because I feel I've missed something important or whatever. But other times I just kind of go with the flow and allow it. Like, you know, it's okay that I didn't hear that part, that one little part, or that I don't feel like I absorbed that fully. I'm still enjoying the process of listening to this book.
Yeah. I rarely reread books, but I finished reading this book a few weeks ago. And then today I was just looking through it to make some notes for our discussion. And I was like, you know, this book is so easy breezy for a mm-hmm. book about such large ideas. It's so conversational. And I was like, you know, I think I might just read this again.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't remember anything I read. And they say that you really can't remember anything you read unless you read it at least twice. So, you know, I really, this book is chock full of, I think, great stuff. I mean, it's like this book is like a long conversation with a friend late at night. It's like, it's right. It's about
that's exactly little what things. It feels like. Yeah.
It's about little things like Coca-Cola or Mario Kart. Or, what's he write about? Not Coca-Cola. Dr. Pepper. Diet Dr. Pepper. There's a review of Diet Dr. Pepper. But then it's also about big things like religion and life and parenthood. It's like
and
about
the significance everything. Of all these small things and how they tie into one another and how, you know, the big things are the little things. That's what a life is made of. I think we spend our lives waiting for these big moments, and these big moments are happening all of the time if you just look at them through the right lens.
And I think that is that's the sort of place that he's writing from. He also, some of the reviews from this book came from the Anthropocene podcast, which I had not listened to. But that sort of inspired the book. But then he was putting the book together during COVID. And much like this podcast, I feel like even if it's not about COVID, it is about COVID.
Yeah, it's definitely laced with the feelings that came during all of that.
Like, he talks at one point about the plague. Right. And it's like, you know, the Black Plague, you know, and he can't help but bring it into COVID and things like that. What's funny is he does it like newspaper reviews. He gives everything 1 to 5 stars.
I love it.
Right. Which is so funny because one of the reviews is sunsets. And it's so funny when he's like, I give sunsets 5 stars. And it's so funny because, you know, some of the chapters are just like, like, just to give you some of the chapter titles, which is each chapter is a review, Humanity's Temporal Range, Halley's Comet, Our Capacity for Wonder. He reviews Our Capacity for Wonder. And then he also reviews Scratch and Sniff Stickers, Velociraptors, Canadian Geese, Teddy Bears, The Hall of Presidents, Staphylococcus aureus, which is staph infection, which he had. Sunsets, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff. Harvey, the movie Harvey. And what's really funny is in each chapter, he gives you some history. He gives you some theory. He'll bring in quotes from poets, and all sorts of great thinkers. He's clearly a brilliant person, but then he'll also digress away from it. Like, to me, one of the most affecting chapters is Googling strangers.
Oh, boy.
And you think, okay, and it starts off funny. He talks about how I'm really good at Googling strangers. But then he digresses into when he was a young man, he was a chaplain at a hospital. And he talks about a time where a baby came in with third-degree burns. And even the staff was freaked out. And just the experience of being a chaplain. And because he had originally wanted to, like, be clergy. And then he kind of, like, got turned off of that. Although he's still clearly a very spiritual person.
Yeah, his faith is kind of laced in everything, and I think that's really beautiful.
His first novel, Looking for Alaska, I think is very, very full of faith. Have you read that?
I read it ages ago. A whole lifetime ago. I would say probably about 15 or so years ago.
Right. It's his first novel. And I think it was originally published and like marketed as a religious book. And then as he gained more popularity, they kind of shifted that marketing. We should say, if you don't know John Green, he's most famous for writing The Fault in Our Stars, which is another incredible YA book. I'd say The Fault in Our Stars, along with Eleanor and Park, are the two defining YA books of the beginning of the 21st century.
I could agree with that. I mean, I love both of those books as well.
Yeah. Looking for Alaska, spoiler alerts for Looking for Alaska, but it's about a kid at camp who like gets a crush on a girl, and every chapter is sort of counting down to something. So you think, okay, it's counting down to he's going to finally kiss a girl. And he does kiss a girl. And then the next day, the girl dies in a car accident. And that's the middle of the book. And I read this as an adult. I read this maybe 5 years ago. And it felt like someone kicked me in the jaw. I read it in one sitting. Not one sitting, but after that point, after the midpoint, after she died, I couldn't put it down. And it got so spiritual about like what is life about and what's the point, because it becomes a mystery of why did she die of suicide? Was it an accident? Why was she driving? Where was she going? And it becomes a point of like, what does that matter?
Right.
So, and you know, I really love that deep space. I find like my anxiety and depression often makes me shallow. It brings me up to the surface of my body, and I wish I could spend more time in having a wider horizon, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think maybe to some degree, because of our illnesses and the things that we grapple with, that, you know, we're wired to protect ourselves in certain ways, and that maybe we don't want to develop even the momentary attachment that seeing, you know, a deeper meaning or a deeper beauty in something might make us feel. But that's
right
where the magic happens, is when you allow yourself to, you know, just be in awe of everything, all these basic, wonderful, I mean, we say basic because they're part of our everyday and whatever, right. But if you decide to take a closer look at the smallest thing in your life and, you know, how it helps you every day or how it makes you smile or whatever, there's a lot to feel awe about. Mm-hmm. In the world. Absolutely. I mean, and you know, there are things that one of the themes that I think that carries throughout the book, he's a sports fan. He's a person who likes sport and teams, right? And stuff.
And he almost makes me want to like sports.
That's, yeah, I was going to say, like, and I am not. I grew up in a very sporty household. My father was very big into sports. I know a decent amount about sports, but it just doesn't grab me in that way. I'm not a sports person. But the way he talks about it and the way he talks about the community that surrounds sports teams and stuff, it's so moving. And, you know, it offered an opportunity to have a really great conversation. Have you watched the show Ted Lasso?
No, I have not yet.
It's fantastic, first of all. It's so good. Jason Sudeikis is hilarious. But, you know, if anybody doesn't know what it's about, it's an American, you know, American football coach goes over to coach a football soccer team, and you know, it's funny and whatever, but points that were made in this book helped me understand some of the show, like some of the little, you know, snippets that they added in between the teams that are homages to different, you know, teams, actual teams in the real world. And you know, it was really nice. And I think it gave me that appreciation for sports and for, you know, the community that builds, because I think sometimes I'm just annoyed with that. I'm like, oh, this is so stupid. You're rallying behind like a guy with a stick. Like, I don't understand what, you know, but, right. When you think about the significance of that and the fact that it brings a ton of people together, and that's what matters more. Like, it's not necessarily the quote unquote spectacle that you're watching. It's the fact that you're all sitting there watching together and enjoying it together, and you're cheering for the same thing, and you're united in that moment. You may be a million different people from different backgrounds who have not another single thing in common, but you're all here for the same reason.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think I always thought of myself as like, oh, I'm an arty person. But then when you come across someone like John Green, who's clearly an artist and a fan of poetry and a writer, but also loves sport, it makes me see it in a different way. Absolutely. I'm trying to find a quote. There's a quote, and I don't remember. I don't think it's from him. I think he's quoting somebody else, because this book is full of wisdom. But it's something like traditions keep you, like, when you, the point of a tradition is you're doing something with everyone who's done it before and everyone who's going to do it after you.
Yeah.
Just such an interesting way to think about tradition.
Yeah. And it's interesting to apply that to sports, because sports in any country, I mean, it varies, but they're rich in tradition. They are, you know, you can trace them back to, you know, indigenous peoples, and like it is something that connects people through time and space. And I've never thought of that. And that's a really, I mean, that's exactly what this book did for me about so many things. You know, I never thought of that way. That's actually really beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He has such an interesting voice, because this book, I feel he has such a fragile voice. He talks a lot about his own illnesses, both physical and mental. He talks about debilitating depression. He talks about having a staph infection. He talks about, you know, he begins the introduction, he talks about an illness where he loses his balance, and there's such a fragility. But it's not like he's sort of coming. It's not like a woe is me kind of voice. It's kind of like, we are all so crazy fragile. Like, be aware of the fact that you're fragile.
Yeah.
I don't know. It opens you up. There's certain points in the book where he says, like, I don't even feel comfortable writing this.
And then he does. Because that's being brave and human. And that's cool.
This is, I think, maybe my favorite book of his. And when I first heard that he was writing a nonfiction book, I was like, huh, what is this going to be? And in some ways, I feel like he's boiled himself down to the core. Like, he has found himself. He even says in the introduction, he's not sure if he wants to write novels anymore, which is a fascinating thing to hear, because he's good at it and he's had a lot of success doing it.
Yeah.
But I would be happy if he wrote this way for the rest of his life. You know, if he became someone like Susan Orlean, who just writes interesting nonfiction books.
See, he kind of in this book a little bit, getting to know, you know, you hear his voice a lot in his novels, but getting to know that a little bit more and a little bit more intimately in this book, where he's writing from the first person about his own experiences. He reminded me a lot of David Sedaris at times, you know, that humor, that dry wit at times, and but overwhelmingly heartwarming in the end. Everything in the end, you know, you'd end every chapter with some sort of smile, whether it's bittersweet or whatever. I actually
none of the cynicism of Sedaris.
No.
The openness and the comedy, but Sedaris sometimes has a sort of snappy cynicism,
which I love.
I love David Sedaris, but I've seen him read live.
Wow. It's almost like a yin yang of David Sedaris. Yeah. Like, he feels like a lighter version to me. You know, it's that same kind of very inviting style.
He's so sincere. He's so earnest. Mm-hmm. John Green is so earnest that it can't help but cut to the core of you, I think.
Yeah, I started listening to this book on a plane.
Okay.
And there were actually a couple of times that I had to like like kind of just not show the people that were in the seats next to me that I was crying. Yeah. The Sunsets chapter did that to me. There were a few, and it's very poignant when you listen to it, I feel like, because, you know, I'm listening to this whole speech and then there's this very like, there's a pause and then there's, I give this thing X amount of stars, and it's, it feels, you know, it gives you chills every time I would hear him say that about whatever the chapter was, what, you know, no matter how deeply it affected me, I would get chills just at the idea of like thinking about everything in the world in this way, you know, reviewing these things that we just interact with on a daily basis, or, you know, we don't interact with at all. We know nothing about, but they exist in the same world that we do.
Right. And it's interesting because it's called the Anthropocene. So he doesn't go that far back in time, but he does go back in some ways. And the Anthropocene is what we might call this geological period. And it's the period where humans had a major effect on the Earth. So really, he's talking about life, but he's talking about us. He's talking about our effect on life.
Mm-hmm.
Early on in the book, he has an essay on the song "Ol Yang Zine," which most people know because it's very associated with New Year's Eve. And I love that song. It's so bittersweet. That song could just make me cry on its own. But his writing on it, just like, I don't know, I really loved it.
And I learned something from it too. I always knew what he references when he's talking about how much do we want to talk, like give away what's in the book and stuff?
I think we could give away stuff.
Okay.
We could say spoiler alert for the book.
Spoiler alert. I don't remember exactly what it is, but the we're here because I can remember my father doing that as I was a kid, when I was a kid and stuff, and I never knew the context of it. I never knew why. I knew it was, you know, to the tune of Auld Lang Syne and all of that, and you know, I would think of it all the time, but that part in the book really struck me. And listening to it on audio,
I don't remember. Do you remember what exactly was the part you're talking about?
I think if I'm remembering correctly, it originated during wartime.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm looking here.
That's all right.
I'm looking it up.
It's fine.
Song Sun in the World War One trenches. And it was basically, it's just, you change the words to "we're here because we're here because we're here because we're here." And he talks about how poignant that is and how the more you think about that, the more, you know.
Right.
We're here because we're here. Like, and at the end of the chapter, you know, he's like, I want you to sing this with me. And I don't know that I would have done it were I sitting down reading the book. I don't know that I would have closed the cover and sang on the audiobook. It pauses for a second. And then he starts singing. And so I started singing with him. And it was this really, really beautiful moment that gave me chills all over my body. And I think that's kind of the feeling the whole book is about.
Yeah. And I'm looking at the chapter now, and something he does that's always amazing is there's always like some little there's some heart at the middle of it, because he, besides talking about that history, he then talks about his friend who died. Mm-hmm. Like that's also what the chapter is really about, because that's what the song Ol Lang Syne makes him think of. What the heck's her name? Amy, she was somebody that she worked with. She was somebody that he worked with. She was in publishing. So it's like, I love that too. I love the digressions of like, yeah, we're talking about the song, but then really we're going to talk about this memory I have.
Right. And it's, each chapter has a bunch of things like that, you know? So it's not just about the one thing. It's about all the other things that calls to mind or signifies. And that's kind of everything, you know, that's every little thing has a significance or has a story if you stop and think about it.
Yeah. You know, I really love what he does in this book, because this is like kind of what I want to do or what I aspire to do. I went to school for media studies, and I consider myself a critic. I have another podcast, Pop Culture Man Children, PCMC, And in that, we talk about movies and TV shows and all sorts of pop culture ephemera. But I see it as criticism because I think we have too narrow a definition of what criticism is. Criticism is us thinking about the stuff we make.
Yeah.
You know, it's called communication mm-hmm. because it's us talking to ourselves. All art, all media is us talking to ourselves. So criticism is us thinking about what we say to ourselves.
Yeah.
So what I love what he does here is, you know, these are reviews, even to the, he even does the crass 1 to 5 star thing, which, you know, most critics would say, you know, how can you really give 1 to 5 stars for everything? But the fact that he does and then weaves in these deeper things, it's really like, I honestly hope that this book has an effect on other writers and criticism in general, because I think the criticism, we think of it two ways. We either think of it as academic, which is good, but also it's cut off from what a lot of people would care about or understand. Mm. It's full of jargon and there's no I in it. No I in it. And the I is so important.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other way we think about criticism is we think of newspaper reviews, which are good in their own right, but they're almost a form of consumer advocacy. They're more, right. You buy a ticket, don't buy a ticket. Criticism could be so much more. This book is criticism. It's not just wrapped up in criticism. It's not pretend criticism with a memoir in it. It is criticism.
Yeah, it's thinking about how we think and look at things.
Right. The I is important. I care about the I, you mm-hmm. know.
Well, I think in most media, a lot of the time we're just looking for ourselves. Right. You know, we're looking for confirmation that we're not alone, or, you know, we're looking for something to relate to. And I think what's great about this book is who can't relate to most, if not all, things in this book.
I know. Because
we're all having the human experience.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite review or one that really got you going?
So there were a few of them that really hit me. But one that's kind of still fresh in my head because I listened to it this morning was The World's Largest Bowl of Paint.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was a really great chapter especially because I didn't care about it when I saw the title or heard the title. I was like, all right, like some of the chapters grabbed me by the title, some of the things I'm interested in to begin with. But I hear that and I just think cheesy roadside attractions.
Right.
It's probably going to be a quote unquote terrible review or whatever. But it was actually really poignant and it was about, you know, us just being human and trying to leave our silly mark on the world.
And working together.
Yes,
and we're all in on
that together. Yes, we all just want to leave a little bit of ourselves behind. We want to make an impact or an imprint.
Right. It started, this roadside attraction, which is a real thing, you can Google images of it. It started, I believe, as a baseball that this father painted, and then he kept painting it. And every time you paint, there is a layer that you're adding to it. So the father and son would just constantly be painting it. They have not opened it, but you know, the father said, I like the idea of thinking about cutting it open and seeing all the layers, which they have not done. But as it became really, really big and became a roadside attraction, now they let guests paint a layer. And I think that's the thing that really gets to Green of like anybody could go and be a part of it.
Yeah. And, you know, whether or not you see the layer that you painted on or somebody painted over it, it's still there. It's still as part of the foundation of that thing that, you know, thousands of people or whatever have together created on their little road trips and random stops and whatever.
Right.
They all stopped and took a second to do this silly thing. And, you know, together they made something interesting, you know, not that it's something necessarily physically beautiful to look at or anything, but it's beautiful because of what it represents. And when you think of it in that way, it becomes more. And I think that that's what this book does about so many little things that I would never think twice about. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's actually really beautiful if you think about it through that lens.
Yeah.
What chapters stuck out to you?
I think the two that really struck me the most were Googling Strangers, which we mentioned before.
Mm.
I actually have some highlighted. I want to read a little bit of it. When I was 22 and working as a student chaplain at a children's hospital, I would spend 24 hours on call once or twice a week. This meant that I'd stay in the hospital with two beepers. One beeper went off whenever someone asked for a chaplain. The other buzzed when a serious trauma case arrived at the hospital. I'm going to skip around. So this baby comes in and the baby's got third degree burns. Someone shouted, "Chaplain," the parents. And I realized that next to me, the little boy's parents were screaming, trying to get at their kid. But the doctors and the paramedics and the nurses needed enough space to work. So I had to ask the parents to step back. Next thing I knew, I was in the windowless family room in the emergency department, the room where they put you on the worst night of your life. It was quiet except for the crying of the couple across from me. They sat on opposite sides of the couch, elbows on knees. During my training, they told me that half of marriages end within a couple years of losing a child. Weekly, I asked the parents if they wanted to pray. The woman shook her head no. The doctor came in and said that the kid was in critical condition. The parents only had one question, and it was one that the doctor couldn't answer. We'll do everything we can. And now I want to skip ahead to later on. Green is not with the parents, and he runs into the doctor. The doctor says, "That kid's going to die, and I know his last words. I know the last thing he'll ever say, and I didn't ask her to tell me what it was, and she didn't answer." This has been sticking with me. What was these kids' words? My instinct would be help or mommy. Mm-hmm. Something heartbreaking. The happy ending, by the way, that brings us back to the point of the chapter, Googling strangers, is he had always avoided doing it, but then at one point he finally did it and he found that the kid's alive and he's an adult and he's okay. And it's such a satisfying ending.
Yeah. Thank goodness.
Yeah. Damn. You know, he's such an incredible writer. Just like where they put you on the worst night of your life.
Ugh. Yeah. He knows exactly how to use words to evoke emotion. He does an incredible job of that. Yeah. And doesn't have to be fancy and, you know, it's these beautifully simple and haunting descriptions of everyday feelings and things.
The best lesson I ever learned on writing was a professor told me in school, like, don't reach for big fancy words. Reach for the right words. Find right. the right words for what you're trying to express. And he's so good at it. He has such an easy hand, too. He almost reminds me, even though it's very different content, he reminds me a lot of Neil Gaiman. The way Neil Gaiman is so, like, the words just flow. Like, there's no other way they could possibly be put together.
Of language.
Yeah, that easy hand. Yeah. You know, there's a line that still sticks with me from The Fault in Our Stars, which I'm going to mangle, so let me paraphrase it. It's something like, it's the beginning of a chapter, and it's, "We fell in love like people fall asleep, slowly at first, then all at once." Oh, my God.
Yep.
What a truth that I've never thought about, but when you say it, oh, my God, is that true?
Yeah.
About sleep and love.
Yep. Yep. About, yeah. And it's, yeah, that's a really powerful line. And that's, again, who doesn't know at least the experience of falling asleep?
Right. Right.
Maybe we haven't all fallen in love yet, but though I think we fall in love in different ways throughout our entire lives.
Right. Well, I sent you a video today of John Green. If you don't know, he does this thing, Vlogbrothers, that they've been doing for a long time on the internet, where once a week, John Green makes a video about whatever he's thinking about, whatever subject, but he always begins it with, "Hi, Hank," as he's addressing it to his brother. And then another point in the week, Hank makes a video back at him. So it's kind of a conversation, but it's about a lot of different things. And today's video, the video that came out today, the day we're recording, he's talking about Esther, and he says it's Esther Day. And Esther, I might be wrong here, I believe is who the character from Fault in Our Stars is based on. She's a 16-year-old girl who died of cancer. He starts talking about, like, love that is not romantic and how it's such a hard, how hard it is to express that. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I'm sorry. I actually sent it to my brother.
Aww.
And then I told him, "I love you." And he said, "I love you back," which is something we really say.
Yeah. And it really is hard to say to friends and, you know, in any sort of non-romantic contact, because we're just so desensitized. And, you know, we're I don't know. We put up walls between people where we shouldn't put them, and we think that intimacy equates to sexual energy or attention or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, intimacy with friends and with family and that kind of love is so incredibly important. Like, it's right. Romantic love cannot fulfill every part of your soul.
In outside of romantic love, I feel like you never regret it. Like, sure, like when I was younger, I'd say I love you in a romantic way and regretted a lot of it. But like every time I've ever awkwardly said I love you to my dad or I love you to my brother, I've never regretted that.
Yeah.
Right. And you never will. One day you'll say, thank God that I said that.
And, you know, it's less of a risk. I feel like it's, I don't know, it's a safer love. It's a different, it's completely different to say that to your brother or, you know, or to a lifelong friend or friend that you just love. And I've been a person who has used that word in an empty context a lot of time.
Sure.
A lot of times with friends or whatever, like, yeah, I love you. And, you know, huge difference between love you and I love you or love ya. But I think, you know, getting more comfortable with saying I love you to the people in your life who you love in whatever capacity for whatever reason is really important. And it also opens the opportunity for you to hear that you're loved too. And we all need that.
Absolutely.
And sometimes that really makes somebody's day just to know that they're loved and it's not because of what they can offer in a relationship or, you know, sexually or anything like that, that it's just because they're loved, that's why, because you are.
Right. And I think we take for granted that the person knows it. Like, oh, they know that I feel that way. But I feel like it cuts through some bullshit if you can say it once in a while and just sort of get back to, you know, home base and be like,
right,
there's love here.
This is where we stand.
I'm sorry to go back, but I'm looking again at the end of this and I kind of want to read this because it's so well written.
Do it.
This is going back to the chapter on Googling strangers. The months of not knowing became years, then more than a decade. And then one morning not long ago, I typed the kid's name into the search bar. And it's an unusual name, easy pickings for Google. I hit enter, and the first link was to Facebook. I clicked over, and there he was, 18 years old, a decade and a half removed from the one night we spent together. He is alive. He is growing up, finding his way in the world, documenting a life that is more public than he probably realizes. But how can I not be grateful for knowing, even if the only way to know is to lose our autonomy over our so-called selves? He is alive. He likes John Deere tractors and is a member of the Future Farmers of America, and he is alive. Scrolling through his friends, I find his parents' profiles and discover that they are still married. He is alive. He likes terrible, overly manufactured country music. He is alive. He calls his girlfriend his bae. Alive, alive, alive. It could have gone the other way, of course, but it didn't. And so I can't help but give the practice of Googling strangers 4 stars. Incredible. The repetition of he's alive, it just gives me chills.
Yeah. And it makes you grateful to be alive. It really does. Just hearing a story like that and recognizing the humanity in it and, you know, knowing that that's something any of us could have experienced, that could have been any one of us, that could have been our family. And, you know, we're always a hair away from the worst imaginable thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It also makes me think about our connection to other people and the internet. There is a chapter in this about the internet where he writes mostly about being a young nerd and finding a community online. But, you know, like there are certain people that I look up once in a while. And some of them don't remember me. Some of them probably fucking hate me. And I'm sure to not like anything or leave any footprints there. But I do want to see that they're doing okay.
Right. I understand that. I would venture to say we probably all do that, you know, and I think I stand by giving it 4 stars because sometimes you just need to know that that person's doing all right. Or, you know, there's obviously a line that you don't cross when doing that. Being able to see that someone still exists in whatever way, whether it's that they checked into a restaurant a month ago, so you know that they were still existing at that point or whatever, because sometimes when you're removed from a person, especially when there's no one in your present life who was there for the relationship with that person or who knows them and can reminisce with you. Sometimes you just have to remind yourself that they existed and that they're real and that they're a part of this world, and, you know, they impacted you, and hopefully you impacted them in some sort of positive way at some point, or, you know, just, it's validating.
Yeah. I love, you know, there's a sort of high school reunion aspect to Facebook. I love seeing people that I have no, you know, we have no problems, but like people that I was friends with in like high school or junior high school, people that if I saw on the street, I might not be confident enough to say hello to, but not anyone that there's any, you know, animosity towards. But I love seeing like that they have kids and what their kids look like, and that, like, you know what I mean? Like, I just love that. You love to see it.
You love to see it. It's true, though. It's nice to have that little catch up that you can do, even if it's just in your own mind for yourself.
Yeah.
Like, just to be able to check in on somebody and be like, all right, you're doing okay. You seem happy, whatever.
You know, when I was a kid in junior high school, I don't think I've ever talked about this on a podcast. When I was in junior high school, I had a short phase as a bully because I got bullied a lot in grammar school and junior high school. And I was, like many bullies, I was trying it out. I was trying the other side of it. And there was this girl who I used to bully all the time. But maybe bully is not the right word. Maybe it is the right word. I would make fun of her. You know, I wouldn't like physically like hit her, but I you know, I'd goof on her and make fun of her and shit. And I remember one day she wasn't in school, and I remember her friends crying, and I remember hearing that she tried to hurt herself. And I remember Mr. Schneider, and I'll say his name because he passed away, but he was a great, great teacher. And he was a Vietnam vet and like a really smart guy, real like badass, really funny guy. And I remember, and I'm a junior high school kid, and we're in the hallway and we're alone, and he grabs me and he puts me against the wall, like pounds me against the wall. And me and him had a good relationship. And he was like, if I hear that you bother this girl again, I'm going to fucking kill you. And I was like, okay. And
all right.
I'll always remember that in a positive way. And she came back to school, and I never bullied her again. And, you know, I lost track of her. I don't remember her name. I wish I could remember her name so I could look her up. But part of me, you know, I bet if I looked around my mother's attic, I could find a yearbook. So maybe I'm not trying hard enough. But yeah, I sometimes think about her because I don't know. She may have no. She, who knows what really happened? She may have just stayed home from school. She may have tried to hurt herself. I don't know. So I still think about her. I probably think about her more than she thinks about me. She may not remember me at all, but I think about her.
Yeah, she probably does. I mean, I think we always remember being bullied. I mean, I don't know. Maybe other people don't, but I feel like I could probably remember most people that bullied me.
Right. Do you ever catch up with those people? Sometimes I see on Facebook people that bullied me, and now they're like 40 and they have kids, and I'm like,
Are you nice now? I hope you're nice.
Were you always nice? Were your parents mean to you?
So I was thinking about this the other day. There were two like main bullies in my story. And one of them, I actually a few years ago ran into, you know, we didn't acknowledge each other, but I saw him and he saw me, and I assume, you know, I'm sure he recognized me, at my kid's doctor's office. But it was funny because even on that day before I had seen him, first off, I remember how great I felt that day. And I have a selfie that I took that day that was on my social media where I posted about how happy I was that I was able to wear the clothes that I wanted to wear and not just whatever fit me.
Right.
Or, you know, something. I know
we're having a good day.
You were feeling
yourself, as the kids say.
I was. And my fit was fire. And
hold on, let me Google what that means.
So I remember being in the doctor's office, and he was an EMT. I don't know if he still is or whatever, but he came in for some other reason. You know, he wasn't there like with his kid or anything like that. Yeah. But I was in the waiting room with my child, and it was interesting to see, because especially he was there as an EMT to help a child. Right. And I saw him being warm and, you know, all this stuff. And it let me believe, you know, whether it's true or not, that he grew up and he changed, and that he is kind, and right. that he chose a field where he takes care of people. And, you know, that's what I chose to take from that interaction.
Right.
And I mean, I've never had the opportunity as an adult to like confront my childhood bully or, right. you know, anything like that. But that felt like a kind of nice resolution.
That is a very nice resolution.
Yeah.
You know, when you're a little kid, a bully is like the devil. Like, oh my God, this is my arch enemy. But yeah. as an adult, you realize when little kids are bullying each other, there's something wrong at home.
Right.
Or somebody's bullying them.
Right.
But there's something that they need that they're not getting.
Or people
and it's
hurt
really
people.
Just about, we're all, you can't make anybody into a bad guy. We're all just fragile. We're all yeah. just fragile little snowflakes. Trying to not hurt each other.
We're just trying to get by. I'm like, I think we talk about mental health more, and we talk about our relationships more than maybe we have in previous generations. And we tend to like, you know, overdiagnose and stuff, I think.
Yeah.
And everybody wants to talk about who in their life is a narcissist or who's, you know, whatever.
Right.
And I think we forget that we're all human for the most part, I don't think these people are sitting there twiddling their thumbs, thinking about how they can hurt someone else. They're just hurting, and that's how it's coming out, because right. they're not aware enough of their own pain, and they're not addressing their own pain. So it's just spilling out in these ways. It's not that they're some evil mastermind. They are wounded. Like, and I think, you know, when we start to look at things through that lens, and we start to realize that it's not black and white and nothing is, and that, you know, you can't just decide that somebody's a villain. You can't decide that somebody is automatically everything is wrong with them and right. they're, you know, plotting against you or whatever. For the most part, they're not really that aware enough to be plotting against
right,
you.
Right, sure.
they're dealing with their own stuff. Right. And that's how it spills out, you know. But I think that time in life where you often end up getting bullied, you know, elementary school, junior high school, I feel like those are usually the hardest. I'm sure people deal with it in high school too.
I had bullies in high school.
Yeah, I feel like it gets different once you get to high school. That it takes on a whole right. you know, different level, because who isn't struggling in their teenage years? And you know, a lot of kids aren't getting help with that, so where is that going to go? Of course it's going to get directed at their peers in some way.
Yeah, you know, it's sad. I had a bully in high school, and you know, there's a bar near where I live, so sometimes I drive by it, and he's always there outside. And sometimes he's even like wearing his like varsity jacket.
I'm sorry, do you live in a sitcom?
I know. By the way, I'm going to be 38 soon. I graduated in 2001. We're talking 20 years ago. And he just seems like a sad alcoholic. And I just feel bad for him.
So that trope is really a thing, huh?
It can't happen. It can't happen.
Oh, boy.
You know, life hurts, you know? Life's hard.
It really is. And without support and awareness, and it's so hard. It really is. And people who don't try, you know, it almost ends up harder. You know, you think it would be hard to try, but not trying can be even harder, because if you're not trying to get better, or you're not trying to manage yourself or whatever, everything's hard. Life is hard. You got to choose your hard. You got to choose to either stay doing the same things that make your current life difficult, or you get uncomfortable and change those things.
Yeah, you're right. Now's a good time to say that me and Kate are not licensed healthcare professionals or mental health professionals. We are not therapists, psychologists, or psychiatrists. We are not learned in the ways of medicine. And this podcast is about us expressing our feelings and not meant to be used in lieu of actual treatment. If you are thinking of hurting yourself, please look at some of the resources that are in the description of this and every episode. Oh, by the way, I found that quote. Tradition is a way of being with people, not just the people you're observing the traditions with now, but all those who have ever observed them.
So beautiful.
I know.
So incredibly beautiful.
Oh, this is I'm trying to, where is this from? I'm looking at when you read on a Kindle, you can highlight things and then it'll save your highlights. So I'm just looking through my highlights. I don't remember what this context was, but I like the quote. I highlighted, "It seems to me that we are making up human nature as we go along." I guess the place that I want to end on, did you read Three Farmers on the Way to a Dance?
That's actually where I am right now. So I haven't finished that chapter.
Okay. All right. But- so it is, you know, it's sort of like real deal criticism. He's talking about a famous photograph of three young guys that are dressed up on their way to go to a dance. And even though we call it three farmers on the way to a dance, actually, they're not farmers, but they are laborers, and they are from, I forget where in the world they are, but they're in Europe, and it's before World War I. So he talks about how, you know, they're on their way to a dance, but they're also on their way to World War I and World War II, where I believe two of them die in World War I. And he just talks about the expressions on the faces of these young men in the photograph and how they've got this sort of look of like young men on their way out, like, oh, look at me, I'm dressed cool. And but, you know, they've got not just their whole lives ahead of them, but like all of history ahead of them. You know, when you think about people in Europe and people in America pre the Great Wars, it's like, boy, you could not have fucking predicted that much pain was coming. And it's one of the, I think it's one of the end essays. And I just thought it was a really, something about it felt like the right way to sort of close the book. Something very poignant about it.
Yeah, that is powerful. I think about it, you know, that immediately made me think of pictures that I have, you know, right before COVID.
Well, he talks about that too.
Yeah, looking at pictures without masks and stuff and being like, oh, remember? You know, even just looking in the background and there's a crowd of people and none of them have masks on, and that's normal and okay, and I'm not looking at it going, ugh. You know, it's right. Just, it's bizarre. And when you think about it that way, you know, you had no idea of the pain and the struggle that was coming.
But you know, one day in the future, we'll listen to this podcast. And we are right now on the other side of something that we don't know.
Right.
And we'll go, listen to us. We had no idea.
Right.
And I don't know if that scares me or gives me a sense of solace.
I feel like it's almost comforting to know that something's always coming. Like,
yeah.
Yes, I'm an anxious person and I'm always terrified that something's coming. But there's something kind of liberating about being like, yeah, something is coming. Something always is going to be coming. Things are going to change. And, you know, unexpected things will happen.
Yeah.
But you've survived up until now, and you will likely continue to survive because you are privileged and you are also, you know, wise and brave and strong and whatever else.
Yeah.
You know, something will always be coming.
Yeah. What you just said, you've survived, I think this is such an important affirmation. And it's an affirmation I've been trying to use a lot myself lately when I fear things that are coming. And by the way, things that are coming could be simple things like, I got to pay my taxes or something scary to me. But I've been telling myself, like, think about what you've already survived.
Yeah.
There's something, you know, powerful in that, I think. Well, this has been an episode of Cuckoo Bananas.
It sure has.
I'm Mike Buongiorno, joined as always by my trusted companion, Kate Gainey.
Woof, woof.
Ridiculous.
Cuckoo Bananas, if you will.
Yes. Cougar Bananas is available anywhere podcasts are found. If you like what you hear, please share us with your friends and loved ones and your ex-bullies. slide into your ex-bully's DMs and just give them a link to this podcast. Let us be an olive branch. Let us be an olive branch. You can also follow at Cuckoo Bananas Pod on Instagram. This was a nice one. This was very nice. I'm glad we talked about this book.
Me too. It was really, really a lovely book and a lovely chat.
We're coming to the end of season two.
Can you believe it?
I really can't.
Nor can I.
We were talking before we were on mic about how time moves differently the older you get. And part of me still feels like we just started season one and we're ending season two. Like, I still very clearly remember, like, our first conversations about the podcast.
Yeah, it's like a lifetime ago. Or yesterday.
It was just the other day.
Just the other day.
All right, everybody. See you next time.
See ya.